You want to move the microphone just closer to you? There.
I'm sorry. In 1990, Mr. Kennedy was sentenced to 328 months in prison for a crack cocaine offense. In 2008, he filed a motion for a crack reduction, for a reduction under the crack amendments, and his sentence was reduced to 293 months. In 2011, he filed another motion under the second round of crack amendments, and the district court at that time found him ineligible for a reduction under the crack amendments.
How close is he to release? He's been in, what, for 23 years?
Yes, he actually had a Maryland case. His projected release date, as we stand here right now, is 2017.
Okay.
If this sentence were reduced, his release would be immediate.
Okay.
The district court found him ineligible based on a quantity of crack listed in the PSR as seized and analyzed. And that amount amounted to 380.392 grams of crack.
And at the original sentencing hearing in front of Judge Gash, his counsel conceded the accuracy of that amount.
His counsel.
Yes or no?
Yes. His counsel conceded that he was that they did not dispute the quantities of crack.
That's what I said. He conceded the amount here.
Yes.
Why does that not end this case right there?
Because
he didn't say anything to dispute that. Under Pinnock, what he said does not cut it. He said, I'm not guilty. That's not disputing the amount, right?
I'm sorry. He didn't actually say I'm not guilty.
Well,
he stood up and said, I am guilty. I have committed an offense and I have sold drugs. With regard to the drugs in Mimi's place in October.
I was in Jamaica, that's right.
And the drugs at Pomeroy Road. So although he didn't specifically dispute the quantity, he didn't identify a quantity.
And didn't Pinnock suggest that he better be a little more specific than this?
Well, I think Pinnock requires that he be specific as to the facts that he's disputing. And when you are dealing with a case that involves vicarious liability such as this, and the person stands and says, I don't have any relationship to that transaction or those drugs, he didn't need to also say, so the drug quantity should be zero for me for those drugs. He was disputing that the liability that was attaching to him for those drugs was his. So
what significance should we attach to Judge Gash's use? I think he used the term computations. He adopted the computations of the PSR. What does that mean? Computations, in my mind, normally refers to numbers, and these were
computations generally in a pre-sentence report. I would say would refer to the numbers, the offense level, and whatever additions, enhancements or reductions to that offense level are applied in the pre-sentence report.
So your argument is that when he was saying computations, that he adopted the computations of the PSR, that it did not include the quantity of the
drug? Certainly did not include the
how do you make that distinction? How do you know that he was parsing it that way, that he was, when he said computations, he was talking about calculations for enhancements, but not the drug level that led to the sentencing range?
Well, all the PSR says is a quantity of 380.392. That is not in itself a computation. The computation would be additional.
Right, no, but I mean, the recommended sentencing range was based on that, right?
That's correct.
Isn't that a computation? You take the amount and you apply it to the sentencing range and you come up with you apply to the guidelines and you come up with a recommended range. Is that not a computation?
Judge Gash, yes, it's a computation within the sentencing guidelines. So anything that's being computed is computed based on this offense level. But how Judge Gash got to, or how the PSR got to 380.392 is nowhere. That is not in the record. And presumably there would have to be a computation. There would have to be additions of different drugs at different locations to get to 380.392.
In fact, our court has weighed in on this, haven't we? I mean, we said it seems that that Gash implicitly relied upon that.
I believe the court in Mr. Kennedy's first appeal stated that it appears as though the district court
So we'd have to now say it appears differently? It appears to us differently now than
the prior panel? Well, the court then went on to say that, and that was related to the four-point enhancement for managerial role. The court said that it appeared that Judge Gash relied on the pre-sentence report in arriving at the conclusion that Mr. Kennedy was a manager. However, the court did not find within the pre-sentence report evidence that would support that Mr. Kennedy managed five people or more. And the court ultimately decided that the record was the only place that it could find evidence to support that enhancement. So even there where the court says it appears that he relied, the evidence in the PSR was insufficient. I'm not saying anything terribly different. I'm saying the evidence in the PSR was insufficient to hold Mr. Kennedy responsible for the 300.392 grams. This court's decision in Asaro and Childress and that line of cases would require detailed findings in the pre-sentence report, actual computations that get you to the number 380.392. That's the conclusion. That is the total. But that itself is not a computation. And
well, isn't our problem compounded by the fact that a page is missing? And I don't know how great a search has been done, but apparently neither the probation office nor the U.S. Attorney's Office nor your file has that page. And for all we know, it has the breakdown of the 380 amount. And I, from what I understand, we also don't have the transcript of the trial, which I think somewhere it adds up to 380 with 18 grams from the Pomeroy and 362 grams from the Mimi Gibbs. I mean, that just doesn't come out of thin air.
I agree that those numbers wouldn't come out of thin air, but they are not in the record. And
as we have it.
As you have it, yes. But the problem is that at the original sentencing, Mr. Kennedy stood up after his attorney made this concession and said, I'm not responsible for these transactions. And Judge Gash did not rule on that.
But he was found guilty of it. I mean,
he was found guilty, but even the government, with the facts that they recite in that they rely on, does not place Mr. Kennedy at the location that those
right.
drugs were seized.
Was his defense counsel at the sentencing hearing somehow negligent in saying we concede the amount?
I'm not sure that you could call him negligent, but it does create a problem that he stands and says, I concede this amount, and his client stands up right after him and says, no. I've sold drugs, and I'm guilty of some of the drugs involved in this conspiracy, but not these two things.
But the jury found him guilty of those two things.
But the jury only found him guilty through vicarious liability, and the guidelines themselves do not allow for a defendant to be held responsible automatically for the vicarious acts of his co-conspirators. The guidelines themselves
right.
in 1989 right. required both jointly undertaken activity and foreseeability. And here, what is happening is he's being automatically held responsible for the full quantity. Judge Gash didn't make a finding. The record is clear that there is no finding that he's responsible for the full quantity. But what the government would have this court do is assume the worst, assume that Judge Gash necessarily concluded that he was guilty for this amount.
Well, wasn't he guilty of conspiracy? Wasn't that one of the counts?
He was guilty of conspiracy and two drug counts.
Right.
He was found not guilty based on the same theory of vicarious liability of the guns that were located in these locations. The problem for the government in conspiracy cases like this is that when drugs are seized at a specific location without evidence at the sentencing court presented or proffered, the government could have simply proffered. If what the government wants you to assume now is true, the government could have proffered when Mr. Kennedy stood up and said, I'm not responsible for those two. It could have proffered to Judge Gash, who heard the trial, Judge Gash, these are the facts that rebut that. The government did not do that. It did not carry its burden at sentencing. That burden lay squarely with Judge Gash. Mr. Kennedy did not have to have a burden himself to stand up and say, I'm only responsible for this amount. He didn't have to incriminate himself in that way. He could stand up under Pinnock and say, I am specifically disputing my responsibility for these quantities of crack. I admit that I'm guilty. Childress doesn't require any more from him. Rule 32 doesn't require any more from him. And the guidelines in effect at the time did not require any more from him. Rather, the burden was on the government, remains on the government, to establish his responsibility because he entered into a joint agreement with someone at one of these locations.
This sounds like an argument that there was error by Judge Gash that could have been raised on direct appeal.
If it would have made a difference in his offense level, yes, it was an error that could have been raised on direct appeal. But that's why Mr. Kennedy has to assume the responsibility of at least 150 grams of crack, because that's the lowest level under the guidelines at the time that that he could have, that he necessarily conceded by not appealing Judge Gash's failure to specifically attribute the drug.
150 would be out of thin air too, right?
No, because that's the amount that he's waived the right to challenge anything lower than 150, because he did not take that appeal. That doesn't mean that he's waived the right to challenge something at 380, because Judge Gash never made a finding that he was responsible for 380. That finding just doesn't exist. It's an assumption.
I look at the two of the three counts that he was convicted of. Count three, possession with intent to distribute 5 grams or more of a mixture containing cocaine base, aiding and abetting on or about October 14th, 1988. That's the 18 grams. And then count five, possession with intent to distribute, and these are possessions, or aiding and abetting, not just conspiracy, to distribute 50 or more, aiding and abetting on or about December 30th, which is the Mimi Gibbs 362 grams. I mean, he's been found guilty.
The quantities that you recite are not quantities that are contained in the PSR, and they're not quantities that are adopted by Judge Gash. That's the problem. Even if they were, the only thing that we know about those quantities is that they were seized at these locations. We don't know whether some was seized in the refrigerator, some was seized in a safe, some was seized under the bed. And at the time they were seized, by the government's own recitation of facts that they pulled from a previous brief, other people were at those locations. Other people had dominion and control. And the problem, once again, in these bigger conspiracies, and that's why this court has imposed a strict procedural mandate for detailed attribution findings when there are many people involved in a drug conspiracy and the defendant is being held responsible vicariously for drugs seized from someone else or by someone else, is that
I don't see the vicarious here. Possession with intent to distribute on those 2 days, or aiding and abetting. That's not vicarious.
But it could only be vicarious because, as the government concedes, Mr. Kennedy was not present at either of those locations. It could only be through a co-conspirator that he possessed, because he wasn't there, he wasn't arrested there. I understand that the government didn't charge it as vicarious liability, but the only possibility that exists when he is charged with drugs at a location that he is not, in a transaction that the government is not saying he was involved with, is that it's vicarious liability.
Constructive possession, you're right.
Constructive possession. Yes. Okay. And so the problem for the government in these types of cases is that often sellers have many different sources. There is no record in this case that the source of those specific drugs that were seized were all from Andrew Kennedy, that they were all part of his specific agreement, and that's what the guidelines require, the specific agreement, not simply Pinkerton liability where he's automatically responsible for any drug seized. That's what the government is asking this court to do, impose Pinkerton liability, where this court has repeatedly reiterated that Pinkerton liability and sentencing liability are not the same. The government has to show and did not show the specific agreement between Mr. Kennedy and someone else to possess these drugs, and that agreement was reasonably foreseeable.
Okay. You're over your time. We'll give you a couple minutes in reply. Thank you. Mr. Apperson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jay Apperson for the United States. Your Honor, Judge Hogan did not clearly err in his factual findings that the sentencing court implicitly adopted the PSR reference and the drug, including the drug quantity of 380 grams, nor did Judge Hogan clearly err in his factions independent factual finding based on its review of the PSR calculation, that was the drug quantity attributed
to the defendant. What's the language Judge Hogan used upon which you rely to say that he says that Gash found that Gash adopted the findings in the PSR?
Your Honor, we cite that in our brief. That was an express finding by Judge Hogan that the sentencing court...
What was the language? In fact, I have a statement in front of me. Now, remind me what he said.
What Judge Hogan said?
Yeah.
Well, one, he had first referenced this court's determination that Your Honor referenced.
Now, I'm interested in
counsel,
what...
And then made a factual finding that Judge Gash implicitly adopted the pre-sentence report. But then he went on and made his own independent... Under Hall, Hernandez, and all the other circuits that have addressed this issue, to make an independent finding based on the entire record, including the PSR, that references the calculation which Your Honor addressed. Paragraph 19 of the PSR refers to the 380 grams as the seized and analyzed cocaine base, and then the very next sentence says the table specifies that between 150 and 499 grams merits a base offense level of 34. That's the only way the court could get to 34, based on the 380 grams as set forth in the PSR. Judge Gass specifically noted that I have referenced, I looked to the PSR and then adopted a level 34 and the guideline range that accompanies it. There's no other explanation. This notion that it was pulled out of the sky is just not so.
Does that paragraph 19 say where the... how they total up 380?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But if you look at the record as a whole, including appellant's later filing of 2255, we put that in our government's appendix, he references the testimony and the drug amounts, cites the very transcripts that we cite in the brief. So there's no dispute. Everybody understood where the 380 grams came from.
What's your explanation for what Mr. Kennedy was doing after his counsel conceded?
Well, Judge Hogan made factual findings with respect to that as well, and found that he had not challenged, had made a legal challenge to his guilt with respect to the two substantive counts, but did not challenge the drug amounts in any way. And that finding is not clearly erroneous. To the contrary, the fair reading of that transcript says exactly right. What the jury convicted me of, I didn't do. I had nothing to do with it because I was in Jamaica. Well, that's a legal argument under Panik. He cannot make that argument as a substitute for a factual challenge to the 380 grams. He never challenged, and Judge Hogan found that. He never challenged that the 380 calculation was incorrect, never challenged that the 380 was not the total from the two seizures. He simply disputed his culpability, any culpability. And, of course, he challenged the sufficiency of the evidence on those counts as well as the conspiracy on his direct appeal, and this court affirmed. So that under a 3582 motion, he cannot come back in now. And Dillon makes it very clear that this question is a very limited scope question of the district court as to what only apply the amended application. And Dillon talks about the guidelines, section 1B1.10, B1, which makes it very clear that you apply simply the amendment, and, quote, all other guideline application decisions remain unaffected. Well, the guideline application is what he's trying to do now. He wants to now say, which he didn't do in the first instance, that you're supposed to give, Judge Gash failed to give foreseeability findings. Well, never asked Judge Gash to make foreseeability findings. In fact, counsel conceded that the calculation was correct. Never challenged that on appeal and had every incentive to do so. If his position was that I'm responsible for zero drugs recovered, he's not going to go up on appeal and not challenge the fact that he's getting tagged for 150 grams of stuff that he said he didn't do. He said none of those drugs on those two dates am I responsible for. So the implication of his, I know he said I'm guilty of something, but he never said I'm guilty of 150 grams. He had every incentive to challenge that on appeal and never did. And then in the 2008 amendment, when his first reduction, after the first retroactive amendments were passed in 07, he came in on his motion in 08 and put in his pleading. He said the drugs to which I was held accountable was 383.392 grams. And he said at the time I didn't accept responsibility. But right, now I reckon
at the time was it's zero rather than 380. 150 would be
out of the blue.
No sense at all.
No sense.
Yeah,
right. No sense. And of course, to the extent that it is not, if you untether the 380, there's no basis for the 34 or the guideline range. And this notion that Judge Gash just picked some figure out of the blue in a right range instead of undefined range of 150 to 500. Well, if he gets 150 benefit, I get to say it's 500. That doesn't help anybody. The reality is the only reasonable reading of this record is that the 34 was based exactly on the 380. Counsel conceded the 380. And Your Honor asked whether counsel was negligent in conceding that amount. Far from negligent, he was looking out for his client. If he had asked for individual findings of foreseeability and actual drug amounts, this defendant would have been held accountable for multi-kilos of cocaine. Because he was the leader and organizer, as this court affirmed, on the direct appeal of a 7-month-long cocaine conspiracy moving kilograms of cocaine. All these locations, he had his fingerprints on the plates where on the large seizure on December the 30th. He was the guy that made it all possible. This isn't a situation like Saro where you're concerned about hub-and-spoke conspiracies where there's a one of the spokes getting tagged with another spoke that he didn't have any idea. This guy's the hub. He's the organizer and leader. He found the locations. He put together the whole distribution network. He was reaping the profits. One of his persons who testified is making $900 a day in cocaine sales. That's all referenced in the PSR report on page 5 before the calculation. They talk about the Skeets testimony at trial and Seymour's testimony at trial. Talks about directing the $900 drug sale. I mean, this guy is the kingpin of this organization, lasting for 7 months. It was only shut down because of the government. His fingerprints were on these drugs, and had counsel pushed for foreseeability findings, this record was fully supported in much larger quantity. That means he would not have been entitled to the 280 reduction he got in the first instance. That was a boon. The sentencing was a boon to him in the first instance because he wasn't tagged with all the conspiracy, all the
drugs. Yet the government drivers. wasn't gonna challenge this at the outset, right? You're making the argument you're making now is this guy should have had a whole lot more time than he got, and in this case the government didn't take that position.
Absolutely right, Your Honor, and certainly we're not asking for to be remanded for resentencing and increase
at all, right? I mean, this sentence reduction you weren't going to object to it at all.
Is that right?
Until the memo came from the probation.
I think that, Your Honor, in the early stages when these amendments were kicking in, I think we were besieged by a number of these, and frankly had not gotten our act together as to how this all shook out, as to how the application of reductions applied retroactively. And of course, the difficulties of doing this are evidenced by this. We got a page missing from the PSR. Transcripts are gone. He's now 20 years later. That's exactly why Dillon says, you know, you don't go into all these ancillary things because it becomes a nightmare. He's stuck with the decisions that he made then. But with respect to whether counsel was negligent, he was looking out for his client because I think, in fairness, on this record, would have gotten tagged with a lot more.
Let me ask you this. Since it is 20 years later, and even though the amendment says just look within the range and consider the 3553 factors and so forth, do you think a sentencing judge, a resentencing judge under the amendment could depart based on, let's say, excellent behavior during imprisonment, or depart downward because of some you know, because he wasn't a good prisoner?
I think the answer is no, and I think Dillon answers that.
Even departures?
I think that's right. I don't see how you read Dillon otherwise.
So
because Dillon dealt with the Booker issue as to whether now.
Right. So if you're looking at the 3553 factors, you couldn't look at rehabilitation and say, he's been in there 20 years, he's been a model prisoner. All I can do is go to the bottom of the guidelines. I can't depart down.
Your Honor, as you're pushing me on it, I don't know the answer. We haven't briefed it in here. Judge Hogan did not do alternative findings with respect to that. Of course, didn't get to that point because he found him ineligible. But on this record, that decision is not factual determination by Judge Hogan. Clearly, not clearly.
No, I'm just wondering if your office has taken that position one way or the other in any other case.
I think they've all been at this juncture, the two that I'm aware of with Mr. Axum that I've litigated. We have not another one in the pipeline, but I think they've all been in this posture where the court has found the defendant ineligible because his range has not been reduced.
Okay.
I thank the court.
Thank you. Does Mr. Axum? Okay, why don't you take a couple minutes?
The government makes many factual allegations, and they pull those allegations from the previously filed brief. And they're basically proffering to this court why Mr. Kennedy is responsible for the 380 grams. And they break it down into two quantities of drugs seized at two locations. But that proffer was not made below. It wasn't made when Mr. Kennedy stood up. And it wasn't made in the district court when Judge Hogan ruled in this case. And all we are saying is that with regard to the quantity of 150, we're not asking the court to pull 150 out of the air. I'm sure if Mr. Kennedy had had his way, he would have been held responsible for zero. But the 150 is the lowest quantity that we know that he did not object to when the sentence was chosen in this case.
What,
he was certainly
wasn't the choice
to
zero
anything.
Or 380 though?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't the choice, even under your theory of the case and what happened, wasn't the choice between zero and 380?
Your Honor, I think it's a fiction that it's a choice between zero and 380. The government just stood here and said there were multiple kilos, that this was a vast organization.
The choices presented to the sentencing judge.
We don't know what the choices were.
Well, the defense counsel stands up. We know what the PSR says, 380. The defense counsel stands up and says, we've conceded that, the calculation.
And the client stands up and says, no, we don't.
Right.
That all Rule 32.
That would be zero. And the judge sentences obviously based on not zero.
But that's an assumption that the client has to stand up and say, I'm sorry, I am responsible only for 125. He doesn't have to stand up and say an exact quantity that he's responsible for. He can distance himself by saying, I was not involved in those transactions, or I was not involved to the degree that the government is saying. The government then stands up and has to proffer why he is responsible for the full quantity that they're saying. He has no obligation at sentencing to tell on himself. He has no obligation to say, no, only 5 grams. He can stand up and say zero.
Right,
and
once the counsel's conceded 380, I think something has to happen or else the judge should accept the 380, right?
This is what I'll say. The pre-sentence report is missing a page. I think that it's an assumption to say that that his counsel was conceding 380. His counsel never said the word 380. He said, we concede the calculations. Mr. Kennedy then, so we don't know what the other page calculations is. We don't know whether it breaks it down, whether it says, as the example I gave, half the drugs were in the bedroom that Jimmy sleeps in with his ID in a bag. We don't know whether the record is devoid. The government made no effort to proffer at the original sentencing. They made no effort, and this is only their obligation. This is never, ever the defense's
obligation. He says that the phrase he uses, the calculation based on the amount of drugs involved in the case. What is there ambiguous about that?
It's not a quantity. right now I'm being asked to explain the quantity of 380, and there is an assumption that his counsel stood up and said 380. He did not stand up and say, we concede 380. But even if he did, Mr. Kennedy stood up and distanced himself from two of the transactions. And we are in this morass not because of the fault of Andrew Kennedy. We are in this morass because the government did not carry its burden at the original sentencing and stand back up, just as it did here today, with a simple explanation as to why Mr. Kennedy should be held responsible for the 380. That can never be Mr. Kennedy's fault. But the government is now saying, because Mr. Kennedy did not stand up and say, I was only responsible for a specific quantity, 125, we should assume that the district court found him guilty of the 380 based on an incomplete pre-sentence report that does not detail. Pinnock requires detail. It requires, even when a pre-sentence report is adopted and a drug quantity is adopted, it requires detailed references to the trial transcript. That is not contained in this pre-sentence report. So we are latching on to the 380 because that's the only number that's out here. And then we are saying, because the defendant has not offered an alternate explanation, he must be responsible for the 380. That is not what the case law in this circuit, that's not what Rule 32 requires. It's not what the guidelines required when they identify sentencing liability as distinct from trial liability, trial guilt. And it's not what any of the cases that this court has decided, Sorrow, Childress, Tabron, Edmonds 1, every case has required detailed findings when the defendant distances himself from specific transactions and objects. There was nothing more that Mr. Kennedy could do. It'd be one thing if he objected before his counsel. He didn't. He stood up right after and said, I am distancing myself from these.
All right. We have your argument. Thank you, Mr. Axton. Call the next case. Mr. Belt, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The primary issue in this case is whether the workshare discount provision, which is in 39 U.S.C. 3622E, which Congress passed in 2006 as part of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, whether that provision restricts the relative prices of separate postal products. Parties obviously disagree on the conclusion, but there's a fair amount of common ground here. The parties agree, for example, that Congress made several fundamental changes when it passed the 2006 law, the biggest one being that it changed the entire pricing model. Under the old law, the Postal Rate Commission was primarily responsible for setting rates, and it did it on a break-even model, where prices were derived entirely from the costs of the postal services. Under the new law, that's been replaced with a modern system of regulating rates for market-dominant products, where the Postal Service can charge market-responsive prices for its products to improve its financial position, subject to an inflation-based price cap. And the hallmark of this modern system is pricing flexibility. But by trying to rewrite the workshare discount provision, and by ignoring other parts of the statute that were enacted at the same time, the Commission has restricted that flexibility and has reimposed the very cost-based pricing model that Congress replaced.
But isn't that in the statute? I mean, the workshare discounts defined or refer to pre-sorting.
Correct.
I think Congress might have spoken in two directions here, in the sense of, yeah, we'll give greater flexibility, but then this provision puts the PRC back in a primary position and defines the statute to have work share discounts include pre-sorting. I don't know what we're supposed to do with that.
I think Congress spoke with one voice, and I think two propositions that are clear from the language make that clear. The first proposition is that prices, rates, apply to products, that the product is the unit to which a rate is applied. Okay, that's clear from the language of the statute. The term product, by the way, this really points to the centerpiece of the dispute between the parties, is over the meaning of the term product. Okay, that term didn't exist in Title 39 until Congress added it in 2006, and it didn't just add it, it defined it. It's in Section 102.6, and it has three elements. It says the product is a postal service, meaning it relates to mailing, with a distinct market or cost characteristic to which a rate or rates may be applied or are applied. So rates apply to products. Now,
but products is not in 3622.
Exactly, and I think that is our point, actually, that products have rates. 3622 isn't about rates. It's about rate discounts. It's about discounts from rates. So if rates apply to products, it necessarily follows that a discount from that rate is referring to a product, not the relative rates of different products. And to the extent that that's not clear, you turn to, I think, the reporting requirement elsewhere in Chapter 36, which is the only other time work-share discounts come up. It was also added to the 2006 law. And the reporting requirement is part of the annual compliance determination, which is the parties agree is the Commission's primary regulatory tool for ensuring that our various prices comply with the statutory requirements. And they make that determination based on information we're required to provide them. And what is relevant here, and those requirements are in Section 3652. And what is significant here is 3652B, which requires us to provide specific information with respect to each market-dominant product for which a work-share discount was in effect. It's in the legislative history, the Senate report that we cite in our brief, page 20 of that Senate report states that the purpose of that provision, the reporting provision, specifically as to work-share discounts, is to, quote, ensure that work-share discounts are properly established. In other words, that we are meeting the substantive requirement of 3622E. And it simply makes no sense that 3622, the work-share discount substantive provision, would apply to a relationship for which Congress didn't even mandate the provision of any cost information.
Well, it's a weird way to write the statute then, because you're complaining about a limitation on a discount for pre-sorting, yet the statute specifically requires a limitation on the discount for pre-sorting.
No, Your Honor, we are not saying that it doesn't have a limitation. There's no limitation on pre-sorting. In fact, our argument is this, that the statute, that 3622E means what it looks like it means. That we're not
When would it apply for pre-sorting?
It would apply, for example, we have single-piece first-class mail, which is a product, and we have pre-sort first-class mail, which is a product. Mm-hmm. The prices for those products are subject to the goals, the various pricing rules set forth for the pricing of products. 3622 deals with discounts from those products. Right. So on the pre-sort product, we offer three discounts for pre-sorting by address, or by sort of, yeah, by essentially by delivery area. We have a one tier for if you sort your mail by distribution center, a second tier if you can sort it by the three-digit zip code prefix, and a third tier for sorting by zip code. All of those are subject to 3622E. And that's, I guess, what we're getting to is that we think the statute, that this provision means what it looks like it means. We're not required to offer discounts from the rates of our products, but when we do, the discount we offer cannot exceed the cost we save as a result of the activities that are subject to the discount. Mm-hmm. Now, their argument to that is that would allow us to evade the work-share discount limitation altogether by just classifying all these discounts as separate products. And that is just simply not true.
The statute speaks broadly, though. You can say this in a lot of cases, but if the statute were intended to say what you're saying, this is a very odd way to get there.
You know,
They would have, it would have been a lot better for you. And again, you can say this in a lot of cases, but it would have been a lot better for you if you used the term product and made clear here what was not talking about this kind of discount from first class.
See, I think that we're talking about not the use of the term product. I think everybody would agree that the product is the unit to which a price is applied. I mean, that's what a product is. it's really over the absence of the word product in 3622E. But again, 3622E is, well, first of all, we're already talking about the world of products, and 3622E is talking about discounts. It's talking about discounts from product prices. They're talking about within a product. I mean, it's necessarily what it means, especially when you combine it with a reporting requirement. And as to the point that we would be able to evade...
Could have just said within a product.
It could have said that, but it didn't have... That's the point. It didn't have to, because we're already talking about the pricing of products. That's what subchapter 1 is about. Chapter 36 is called rates. Subchapter... uses the term rates. Subchapter 1 is rates for market-dominant products. These are the rules for our products.
And you argue that that's clear enough to knock out our Chevron deference.
Yes, I think it's... Absolutely. I think, I mean, whether it's just the language alone, but it's the structure of the statute, it's the legislative history, and it's the normal rules of statutory construction that you have to give effect to all the different provisions of the statute, including the reporting requirement, including the definition of product. I think all those things together mean this is a Chevron 1 case. And even if it's not, their interpretation is unreasonable. Our interpretation effectuates all the, it gives meaning to all the terms of the statute and effectuates the purposes underlying the change in the pricing model. Their interpretation produces an anomalous outcome, that the price charge for our most efficient and our most profitable product is derived mechanically from the price of some other product. And it furthers none of the goals of the statute. In fact, the commission's brief suggests that those goals are really irrelevant to this question. And it affirmatively frustrates...
The goals are so conflicting, it's hard to, you know...
I'm sorry?
The goals are so conflicting, it's hard to say there's one unified goal here.
I think that's fair to say, and I think
it's
that goes...
compromise, clearly, of multiple competing interests.
And that speaks to that pricing is designed to be a complicated sort of nuanced undertaking with a lot of goals and a lot of factors to consider. The commission is trying to reduce the most important decision we make, which is the price for our most profitable product, to an exercise in arithmetic.
The statute should have just let the Postal Service charge as it sees fit then.
If it
wanted market flexibility, the commission would be gone.
It's pricing flexibility within certain parameters. But one of the parameters is not this work share discount provision, which is limited to discounts from rates. It regulates situations where we charge a discount, or we give a discount or a derivative rate from the rate of a product. I think that's very clear.
Let me stop you and ask you about standing, because the PRC raises standing, and it may seem odd to say that the service cannot, challenge what its boss has done. But as I see it, you have two injuries. That is, that this was forced action. You would have come up with a different rate if you hadn't had to do this. And I want to ask you how you've established that. And then your second injury is this loss of future flexibility, as I see it, and to me, that's very speculative. So how have you established both of those injuries, and is there another injury that you have?
I'll speak to the second one first.
All right.
The restriction on our future sort of prices.
Those are the two injuries.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Those are fair categorizations. But I think the important thing on that second one is this is a rulemaking. This is not an adjudication over whether our present rate design complies with the statute. The annual compliance determinations for that. And it was also not an adjudication over whether single-piece first-class mail and pre-sort first-class mail are separate products. They are. The commission has determined they are. There's a proceeding for that, which is under 3642. This is about our pricing rules going forward. These are about the rules that apply to the decisions we make. And we need to know those rules before we make our pricing decisions in any given year. I mean, pricing, first of all, price adjustments are an annual occurrence, and they are complicated undertakings. As Your Honor suggested, there are a host of factors we consider, market, cost factors, the policy, the statute, in coming up with a meaningful rate design. We need to know in advance what those rules are. And this is a rulemaking establishing the rules. And we disagree that the rule it came up with, which is that Section 3622E speaks to and restricts the relative prices of separate products. We think that's inconsistent with the statute. And if we couldn't challenge it now, the only thing we really could do is either acquiesce, or we could propose a set of rates that we knew would be struck down, that would defy the commission's rule, and then come back here and challenge them then. And I think that there's really no reason for us to have to do that, because in doing that, we will first put some, there will be some uncertainty, certainly, and maybe even chaos in the mailing industry over what our rates are while they're held at suspension. We'll be foregoing needed revenue at that time. And I don't think that the law for a rulemaking requires that we have to actually defy a rule before we can challenge its applicability or challenge its validity. As for the present, the present effects, which is what you labeled, I think, our first argument, we can't say that we would have come up with a different rate design but for this rule. We can't say that. We could have said, all we can say is we would have considered it. They foreclosed, really, what happened in the last price adjustment is that the permissible inflation-based cap, if it were applied, for example, to the price of stamps, would have resulted in a price that was in between 46 and 47 cents. And because that's not how we price stamps, I mean, that's not, you know, the whole, as we call it, the whole integer constraint, that the public really doesn't want to spend 46.38 cents for a stamp, that we had to choose between going to 46 and going to 47. Under the commission's rule, we couldn't really go to 47, because that would have violated the permissible gap between that product and Presort. So although I can't say we would have come up with a different price regime, we would have considered it. And I will say as well that for the next price adjustment, this problem is going to be even more acute, because what was then a 5.9% permissible cap that the commission says comes out of the statute somehow is now going to be smaller, it looks like. We filed our papers, our annual compliance report papers, that suggest that even under the commission's analysis, that number has shrunk. So we can't even maintain the status quo going forward. I mean, we're going to have to artificially raise the price of our most profitable product. And that itself is a problem, because it runs into the problem that rates be just and reasonable as a whole. So they're sending us on a collision course by producing this anomalous result, they're sending us on a collision course with other goals of the statute.
If you raise the prices for the pre-sort, what happens in the marketplace? I'm a little fuzzy on what you think will happen.
We think that if we raise it too much, there's no question that if we raise it, we're going to lose volume, right? So the question is, are we going to lose enough volume that makes it not worth raising the prices? We believe that the answer, if we go too high, is yes. And it's not like these pre-sort, I want to be clear, what we're calling the pre-sort product is really bulk mail, okay? That the term, we call it pre-sort, but it appears in the mail classification schedule as bulk mail, bulk first-class mail, as opposed to single-piece first-class mail, and that's really the primary distinction between these two products. That, you know, bulk mail is really mail for high-volume mailers. It's mail for specialists. It's for big businesses with big, massive, single mailings that are subject to a host of other requirements. Our concern, these mailers are not going, if we raise the price too much, they're not going to the single-piece product. They're leaving the mail system at a time that we need as much of this stuff as we can get. We can't afford to have our most profitable product and our most profitable mailers leaving the postal system. And that's the effect of having to raise these prices, artificially. The statute doesn't command this at all.
How do we know what Congress thought about that prospect?
Because the entire rate design is based on pricing flexibility. It's based on our ability to price our products to the market. It simply makes no sense that Congress would have that as its guiding principle with a host of factors we should be considering, and at the same time make the most important decision, the price of our most profitable product, not really a decision at all. Just index it to some other. In no way does the statute say that. And so it's, even if there's some ambiguity over how Congress structured the statute, I think that ambiguity is resolved by the fact that their interpretation makes no sense. It takes the most important pricing decisions we make, ones that are clearly anticipated by Congress to be ours to make, and turn them into sort of a formula. And that's just not at all what Congress had in mind.
Well, they give on the one hand, take away on the other. That happens all the time.
Well, I don't think they what they gave on the one hand is pricing flexibility.
Exactly.
What they took away is a market-based price cap.
Exactly.
But that has nothing to do with this.
Right. Well, that's the question.
Well, in that case, then the answer is no. That's not what they intended to do. They intended to impose a market-based price cap that gave us flexibility to be nimble in the marketplace, subject to a price cap. In no way does that talk about the relative prices, certainly the through the workshare discount, why would they through the back door? Why would Congress say all that stuff we just said doesn't mean anything as to the big products? That's just somehow the workshare discount provision means that those can exceed no more than 5.9 cents. None of this is in the statute. The statute is about pricing flexibility. The workshare discount provision is about discounts from prices. It's a limited provision.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
We're talking about market dominant products, first of all. So is Valpak a bulk mailer?
They're a bulk mailer.
Okay, so if the rate, the market share discount forces them not out of the postal service, but into single piece? You're not going to lose Valpak.
We won't lose Valpak, but we might lose their advertisers. We're going to lose them to Standard Mail, which is far less profitable. That's a whole different class of mail. They're not going to pay the single piece rate. They've made that clear.
Why? I just explain why.
Because it's just not cost effective. It's too expensive. It's too expensive. Okay. It's not cost effective for them. So they're not going to accept a bump up to a single piece rate. They are going to either, and it's all the major mailers and the pre-sort bureaus that testified or submitted comments in this case said one of two things is going to happen.
Right.
If they can, they'll go to Standard Mail. That's for advertising and things like that. And otherwise, they're just getting out of the mail. So for businesses
not
that are
not mailing anything.
Well, they go to email. I mean, this is our problem. This is a problem fundamentally that we face. You're a regulated entity that is subject to an inflation-based price cap with declining volume. I mean, that is already in some ways a recipe for disaster. But what we do have is the ability to try to respond to the market. And the commission's order says, yes, except for 80% of your first class volume and profit. Why? Nothing in the workshare discount provision, which is about rate discounts, not rates, says anything about that. And I don't think they can come up here and explain why Congress would have designed a system that way. I don't think it's particularly unclear what Congress said. They said products have rates. If you apply a discount from a rate, you're subject to certain rules. But otherwise, you have flexibility to charge your prices to market subject to a price cap. That's a very straightforward reading of the statute, and it's one that, for some reason, the commission fails to adopt, and I think that it violates Congress's clear intent, which is to give the Postal Service pricing flexibility.
All right,
I'm way over.
No, I'm not through with Valpak.
Okay, fair enough.
So Valpak goes from a market-dominant product to a competitive product when it goes to email, if it does?
Well, email's not a product. It's not a postal product at all. It just leaves the mail system. We make nothing.
Okay.
Standard mail's the next tier of service that is also a market-dominant product, but it's far less profitable.
Right. You lose. Is there an example of a market-dominant product that would move to competitive based on a workshare discount?
No, I can't think of any, Your Honor. I think our concern and what we face is our main competitor, certainly for mail, is electronic communication. No question about that. And that we have to be able to offer market-sensitive pricing to keep our most important mailers and mail in the system. And this overreading of the statute frustrates that purpose. If the court doesn't have any questions, it would be great to have some rebuttal time, but that's up to Your Honor.
We'll give some time and reply. All right. Mr. Tenney?
May it please the court, I'd like to just start by talking about standing. On the issue that has been discussed this morning, there's a second issue on which we really think they don't have standing, which hasn't come up today. But on the issue that they've discussed, we think it's probably true that they do have standing, as presently advised, primarily because of the last point opposing counsel made, which is that the most recent analysis suggests somewhat more of a restriction on the pricing that they can give. Now, we're still troubled by the fact that they haven't made specific allegations that we're not saying that they have to defy the caps in order to defy the rules in order to challenge them, but we're troubled by the fact that they haven't made a specific allegation, here's the rate or range of rates that we would like to apply and feel constrained. But given the change in factual circumstances which came up after the briefing, we think it is likely that they do have standing to challenge this. On the merits—
Does all this make sense? That seems to be the primary message we're getting, is that it wouldn't make sense to read the statute this way. So tell us why it makes sense.
Well, there's a few reasons. One is that you know, what Congress was doing in the workshare discount, I think, provision, I think we all can agree, is limiting the postal service's flexibility. It wasn't unfettered flexibility. It was clearly imposing a limit on the flexibility. And what it was doing specifically was saying, if you're giving a discount to certain mailers who perform certain tasks that make the mail easier to process, one of which is pre-sorting, which is listed in the statute, then we don't want those discounts to be so big that encourages mailers to do work that would be more efficiently done by the Postal Service. That's clear from the text and the history. We know from the history also that this concept didn't originate in the 2006 statute. This concept had been around for years under the Postal Rate Commission, and it had applied to the difference between single piece and pre-sort first-class mail for years. And the Postal Service says, well, that all changed because that was back when we were calling things subclasses, and now Congress, without saying, oh, and this doesn't apply to the difference between these categories, and of course, which categories were going to be denominated as separate products was not known to Congress when it enacted the statute. Apparently, Congress was predicting that these two things would be called separate products by the Postal Service. Congress didn't give the Commission really any power to dispute that because it defined product so broadly that anything with a distinct cost or market characteristic qualifies as a separate product. So the Postal Service goes to the Commission and says, we want these two related sets of mail, and there's ample evidence in the record that mailers are choosing between them based on price. Mailers are deciding whether the discount that they're getting is worth whether it's worth it to get the discount given the costs they have to incur in order to pre-sort the mail themselves. And the commission, it's not clear what the commission was supposed to do. So the commission gets a request to call these two different products. They meet the statutory definition of different products. The commission says, okay. Then the Postal Service comes in and says, okay, now this discount that we're giving among these two things, we don't want you to consider it under the workshare provision, which says nothing about products, because we want, because now that we've defined them as separate products, we get to price them however we want. Now, in response to the point about people leaving the mail, or that this is going to cause harm to their...
Right. Isn't the theory that they need greater discounts to keep people in the system altogether? And that may, your response may be that's a great policy argument, not in the statute, but...
Well, it is in the statute, but it doesn't get you out of the workshare discounts entirely. There are a number of exceptions in the statute, and they can argue that one of those exceptions applies.
Such as?
For example... I'm on page A8 of the appendix. It says, nothing in this subsection shall require that a workshare discount be reduced or eliminated if the reduction or elimination of the discount would, A, lead to a loss of volume in the affected category or subclass of mail and reduce the aggregate contribution to the institutional costs of the Postal Service from the category of subclass subject to the discount below what it otherwise would have been if the discount had not been reduced or eliminated. Now, they can say... They can say they qualify for this exception, or they can not make that showing, and if they present that argument to the commission can consider it. But the idea that the possibility, unproven, that complying with the workshare discount provisions would lose them money means they just get out of the statute entirely there's just no basis for making that contention. There's other exceptions. There's a general one, reduction or elimination of the discount would impede the efficient operation of the Postal Service. That's 2D, which is just above what I read on A8. They can argue for all of these exemptions. It's not clear, certainly on this record, that any of them would apply or wouldn't apply, but that would be for the commission to make in the course of a future proceeding. But the point is that Congress was imposing a restriction. They meant it to be a restriction. That much is clear. They didn't limit it to products. He says products have rates. Products have a rate or rates. That's in the definition of products. The idea that something stops being a discount because the Postal Service has defined the two things as two different products, there's just no basis for that in the statute. It just doesn't say so. The commission explained in its order the role that products play in the statute. The main distinction is, just stepping back, there are competitive products, which are things that other entities can offer competitively, which would be like express mail fast delivery would compete with Federal Express. And competitive products, the statute specifically says, and this is 3633, that each product has to cover its own costs. So Congress specifically tied to the product definition in the context of competitive products some of the rules. And the other thing is, you know, they point to the reporting requirement, which is just sort of a comprehensive requirement. You have to, for each market dominant product for which a discount is in effect, you have to report the data. And then the reporting requirements specifically require the commission to assess the legality of the rates that have been imposed for products individually or collectively. So there's really nothing in the statute that says, oh, this only works at the product level. It doesn't work at a more aggregated level. That's just not in the statute, and the statute makes perfect sense the way that it's written and the way that the commission has interpreted it. And then, as the commission pointed out, as a factual matter, there are these pre-sort bureaus. This is an example. The commission gave econometric evidence and other evidence, lots of evidence about the relationship between single-piece and first-class mail. But the simplest, perhaps, is there are entities, and you can say, I want to pre-sort my mail because I want to take advantage of the discount. And I will pay this entity money, and they will pre-sort my mail and take advantage of the discount. Now, if the discount is big enough that the amount that I have to pay to the pre-sort bureau is less than the amount that I'm getting from the discount, then it's worth doing that. Otherwise, I'll just send the mail out myself. I won't pay the pre-sort bureau. Now, this is a classic example of the size of the discount is governing whether someone more efficient is doing the work, whether it's the pre-sort bureau on the one hand or the postal service on the other hand. So it makes perfect sense to apply this. You know, the theory of the work-share discount provision applies perfectly well to the difference between pre-sort and single-piece mail. The language of the statute applies perfectly well. There are policy arguments which they could either address to Congress or they could try to fit within one of the several exceptions to the statute. So they're really, the commission's reading, and on top of it all, of course, the commission gets Chevron deference. The statute certainly isn't clear in limiting this to within products when it doesn't say within products at all in 3622.
To the extent they want market flexibility, however, this impedes their market flexibility.
It does.
Right. Their theory is that the statute's primary objective was to increase the Postal Service's market flexibility so as to compete in a changing environment.
And there's no question that the statute, taken as a whole, greatly enhanced their flexibility. It got rid of the break-even requirement.
But it's still worried about monopoly power, right? I mean, it's a conundrum here, right? I mean, Congress is trying to thread the needle.
Right. It's still imposed. It didn't eliminate all regulation. Right. If they wanted maximum flexibility, they wouldn't have enacted 3622 at all. But they did enact it. And then some of the objectives of the statute, like the first one, for example, is about increasing efficiency and incentives to reduce costs. So that would be one that that would be served by reading the discount provision the way it's written and the way the commission has interpreted it. And of course, there are other ways that they could, use flexibility. There's a cap at the class level, which means for all first-class mail, to make sure they're not increasing prices too fast. And that's mainly a concern about monopoly power. Then there's the work-share discount provision. And there's one other provision about certain preferred categories of mailers, like nonprofits. That's the list of things that restrict their flexibility that are mandatory, sort of specific quantitative provisions. So, you know, we gave this example in our brief. They say they don't want to do it, and that's fine because it's up to them. But they could, for example, distinguish among single-piece mail. They could say, okay, if you're handwriting your address and putting a stamp on it, that costs us more to process, so we're going to charge more. If you're sending it out, in a sort of more machine-friendly way, we'll give you a discount. There might be some restrictions on that, but they certainly could do that. We're not saying they have to. They can. What Congress was doing was giving them flexibility. That's one way in which they have flexibility. But the main point is that the one thing that Congress made clear was that rate discounts for pre-sorting are subject to this provision unless one of the exceptions applies. And they can argue for an exception in a future proceeding if they want, but the provision applies on its face to the relationship at issue here. Unless there are more questions about that, I want to turn briefly to the other issue in the case. And this relates to, once it's a given that the work share discount provision applies, how is cost avoided calculated? And on this, as I mentioned at the outset, the Postal Service really doesn't have standing because what the commission was doing basically was figuring out, okay, we know that the work share discount provision applies, and we're trying to figure out how to calculate cost avoided. And they were just choosing, just in broad strokes, between a narrow definition of cost avoided, which would make lead to a lower estimate of cost avoided, or a broader definition that would lead to a higher estimate of cost avoided. And they picked the higher one. In other words, they said, if there are things you do that, you know, if someone's going to barcode their mail before they submit it to the Postal Service, then they need to make sure that the addresses comply with certain characteristics to make sure the barcoding is useful. And we'll, when we're figuring out how much it's worth to the Postal Service to have someone barcode, we will assume that they are doing the address cleansing, as they call it, also. And so the values of the Postal Service of barcoding, as measured by us, will be higher. And that all that's going to do is mean that the permissible size of the discount is greater. Now, that's perfectly consistent with the statute, but for standing purposes, also, a bigger permissible discount gives the Postal Service more flexibility, because the statute doesn't require any discount. 3622 is just a ceiling on the size of discounts. It's not a floor. So if the commission had come out differently and they would have been allowed to give a discount of up to 3 cents, and now they can give a discount of up to 4 cents, the Postal Service is better off with the 4 cents than with the 3 cents, because they can do anything up to four in that hypothetical. So we think that that's pretty clear that they don't have standing, because it didn't harm them, and in fact it helped them. But that also, I think, is an explanation of why the commission's reasoning is right on the merits, because it's not expanding the definition of work sharing. It's saying, we know that work sharing, the work share discount provision applies, and the question is, how are we measuring the cost? And so that's only going to come into play if they're doing one of the four things that's enumerated in the statute. So on that provision, I just wanted to make our points, but the standing point should be dispositive on that one. Unless there are any more questions. Thank you.
All right. Does Mr. Bell have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Oh, thank you. The commission has suggested that we could define a new category of products, or we can do whatever we want with products. It's totally false. Okay, the commission determines what the products are. That's clear from 3621 and 3642. The commission determines what the products are, and that determination has consequences, because that is the distinction between the normal pricing rules, that if you have a product, the statute contemplates that you apply that price to a product based on its market and cost characteristics. Discounts are discounts within products. If the commission believes that we are trying to somehow evade the statute by miscategorizing things, it has a process to resolve that problem under 3642. And I want to quickly characterize, so this idea that it's up to us to do it is totally false. It's totally false. I mean, the reason single piece and pre-sort, first class mail, are separate products is because we asked them to approve it.
What about the idea, this is a slightly different point, but the idea that there is an exception in the statute if you don't like the limitation they've put on the discount?
That's because, again, these aren't discounts. We think Congress did not empower the commission to grant exceptions at its discretion. It did not give the commission the power to regulate or restrict the relative prices of separate products. I want to be clear on this product. I think where some of this confusion comes from is we have a product called pre-sort first class mail, and we have discounts that are often called sort of pre-sorting. They're different. Okay, again, for the pre-sort product, the product is bulk mail. It's bulk mail for major mailers subject to a bunch of additional requirements involving mail design, everything from ink color to paper stock to rigidity. This is very specialized mail. The discounts from that product are for sorting it by address, okay? So the whole thing isn't a discount. It's a discount from the bulk mail product. So if you have a 500-piece mailing...
Bulk mail is a discount from the first class.
It's not. It's a totally different product. It's a different type of mail and different mailers. It has a host of requirements that have nothing to do with... Single piece is designed as a one-size-fits-all. Look, I want to send a letter. I don't want to read the domestic mail manual. I will put a stamp on it. I'll run it through a meter. I'll send it. It's going to cost 46 cents. Mm-hmm. That's single piece first class mail. Mm-hmm. Businesses use it. Individuals use it. This mail is mail for specialists. If you have a single mailing of more than 500 pieces, and you want to comply with a host of requirements involving mail piece design, presentation, preparation, then you are a bulk mailer subject to the bulk mail product. If you then further want to pre-sort by address, you get discounts.
I got it. Can you quickly address standing on the second issue?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say. This is a rulemaking.
No, on the second issue.
Oh, on the second issue. But whether
I hear you on the first issue. Right. The issue of the methodology for the discount.
Oh, on that issue.
Yeah.
I think that the problem
the
there.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question.
More beneficial to you than the alternative, so why are you harmed? I think that's the theory.
Right, sure. The answer to that question is by calling these things workshare discounts, as opposed to what they are, is just discounts having nothing to do with activities that replace work we do. It subjects discounts to restrictions under 3622E that are otherwise unrestricted by the statute. So, for example, we offer a discount.
Once you get past that into the size of the discount, so the methodology for the discount, I think they were saying that the methodology chosen gave you more flexibility than the alternative methodology they could have chosen, and why, therefore,
right,
within that analytical box, why are you harmed?
Well, the alternative methodology was false and invalid, as the commission recognized. So it's not like they could choose between choices of methodology. The method they chose was to use all metered mail, sort of as a proxy for businesses, as lower cost mail. The idea would be that sort of lower price meter mail should be benchmarked to pre-sort, and that way we would be free to freely raise the price of stamps on ordinary Americans. That's something we disagree with, but it's essentially what their analysis. So it's true that it gives us a little more flexibility to help big businesses, and that's good, and that's profitable. But there's cost to that. But again, I don't think it's a choice of methodology, because the methodology they had employed in the past was invalid. I mean, as they recognized, that's why they started the rulemaking on that question. But again, our key issue on this is that why would Congress have bothered to enact a law that gave the Postal Service flexibility, pricing flexibility, to price our products to the market if at the same time, without announcing it, they were going to take away that flexibility entirely for most of our profitable products through the workshare discount provision, which itself doesn't talk about rates, doesn't talk about prices. It doesn't talk about rate differentials. It doesn't talk about relative rates. It doesn't talk about anything other than discounts from rates. The commission determines what the products are and therefore determines what units rates can be applied to. Once it makes that determination, then we have the flexibility to price our products to the marketplace. It's that simple. And I think that the structure of the statute makes it very clear. I don't have anything else to say, Your Honor. I ask that
I've
the court...
I've got one question.
Yeah, sure.
I'm afraid to ask because I...
You don't want to know?
If the benchmark should not be metered mail, what should it be?
We have no problem if we are required to pretend that our most profitable product is not a product at all, but is just a discount from some other product. We have no dispute with the benchmark they chose, because they are correct that their earlier benchmark they used was this fictional category of bulk metered mail. That product doesn't exist. I mean, there isn't. Their theory was that there are a bunch of bulk mailers out there, so they have massive mailings, but they're essentially just throwing them into a mailbox. That's not literally what it says, but that's sort of the theory, that we have all these bulk mailers out there that are paying single-piece rates, and we should benchmark the pre-sort, the bulk mail product, to that. They have since been convinced there's always been a dispute over whether there are such mailers at all. The pre-sort bureaus really were aimed at those. The council spoke of the pre-sort bureaus. Those are aimed at high-volume mailers that essentially don't know about the domestic mail manual, don't know about the various requirements, don't know that they could actually be paying lower rates if they did certain things, like use a certain rigidity for their mail pieces, if they trade them, if they face them and did all that. That's what the pre-sort bureaus do. It's not like they're coming up to you and me and saying, hey, we can aggregate all your mail and you can get pre-sort prices. That can't happen. So... I've now lost my train of thought entirely.
let me tell you what I'm bothered by. If one looks at 3622E, it doesn't say products, right? It's not there.
And
so you have to resort to this argument of structure to say that it's clear. How often do we do that? How often do we bypass the specific provision at issue, which seems to indicate a different outcome than what you're referring to, and rely on structure and purpose? That's a... Isn't that a little bit dangerous?
That's a normal tool of statutory construction, Your Honor, that if a... if you read the four corners of one provision is unclear because it doesn't mention the word product. And again, we would argue that's not surprising.
Have you got some examples of where we've done that? We bypassed the provision and went to the structure?
I can't cite any to you right now, but I think it is not uncommon for this court to say, okay, if I read the four corners of the challenged provision, I don't know the answer, but by reference to other simultaneously enacted provisions, it's obvious what Congress must have meant. Because the goal of this is not to discern what the plain language is, it's to discern congressional intent. And I think congressional intent is clear when even
Is that the purpose?
That is ultimately the purpose. The best indicator of that is language. Sure, language, structure, and the rules of statutory construction, but the point is, what did Congress mean? And, I mean, the best indicator is, what did it say? We argue it is not at all surprising that it wouldn't mention the term product in 3622E itself, because the whole thing is about product.
I guess the question is it absolutely clear?
I would say that 3622E alone is maybe not all the way to being clear. Yeah, I think I would argue it is
mostly clear.
I think it's mostly clear. No, I think that's fair to say because the whole thing is about products. The entire the opening section of the statute talks about rates for market dominant products. The whole thing is about products. So its absence in that one provision is not surprising at all. The whole thing is about products. But I think what makes it clear is when you combine it with the reporting requirement, which is now outside of the world where we're talking just about products, and it says you have to report information for your market-dominant products for which there is a workshare discount. I think you combine those two, and it's entirely clear. That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Shelley, good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Shelley on behalf of the appellant Michael Oki. In our briefs, we've listed three different reasons as to why the district court erred in dismissing the case for lack of jurisdiction. One reason is because the court relied on a preclusion rule stemming from the Northwest Airlines case, and we assert that case is no longer good law. Another reason is because the lower court found the Railway Labor Act, the RLA, arbitration requirement to be jurisdictional. We assert it's not jurisdictional and that it can and has been forfeited. But the court doesn't need to get to either of those issues if it doesn't wish to, because the court can accept the Northwest Airlines preclusion rule and that it's jurisdictional use it here in the sense that of applying it as good law, but in the end, on the unique facts of this case, it has no application or operation. So I'd like to just for a second talk about the facts because they are relevant, obviously, to the application of the rule. Mr. Oki served as a U.S. Airways pilot starting in 1988, and upon contracting leukemia, he began obtaining benefits. This is about 2002. He began obtaining benefits from the U.S. Airways disability plan. He received those benefits for about a year, and then he was furloughed by his employer. And he was sent a letter saying that because of the furlough, you're no longer going to receive your disability benefits. This letter that he received is quite important for what it states and what it doesn't state. First of all, it doesn't state the basis on which the plan provision on which this termination of benefits was based. That's a violation of Department of Labor regulations. What it did state was that if Mr. Oki didn't like the termination, he could administratively appeal that pursuant to ERISA, specifically mentioning ERISA. It also said that if he didn't like the result of the appeal, after the appeal, he could file a suit in federal court under ERISA. The letter made no mention of the Railway Labor Act, no mention of an arbitration requirement. It just said ERISA. And so Mr. Oki, when he got his termination letter, his benefits termination letter, He thought it was wrong because he never understood that the plan allowed for termination of benefits based on a furlough, and so he requested an explanation from the plan. What provision of the plan are you relying on? Over and over he requested, and finally he was sent one page from a 1997 restatement of the plan. And it said that had a provision in there that you're not entitled to benefits if you've been furloughed. Well, the plan also never issued a summary plan description for him to understand his rights, and ultimately then not agreeing that the 1997 plan was at all valid because in his view it had never been signed by the union, and that an earlier plan, the 1975 plan, governed, he did what the letter that the plan sent him told him to do. He filed a lawsuit under ERISA. And he filed it back in 2003. And ERISA is a comprehensive statute. It applies to every private employer benefit plan. It applies to unionized plan. It applies to collectively bargain plans. It applies to railroad plans. It applies to airline plans. The only plans it doesn't apply to are church plans and government plans. This isn't either of those. So he filed his lawsuit under ERISA. It went on for several years. There were a lot of other parties, a lot of other claims. 9 years later, U.S. Airways raises the allegation that the case is barred for lack of jurisdiction because Mr. Oki should have used the arbitration remedy under the RLA as opposed to the ERISA remedy it told him to follow. There are cases that hold that the RLA can preclude an ERISA claim. We assert that this isn't good law anymore, but let's assume it is for now. All these cases set forth the same standard, and I don't think there's really a disagreement about the standard at this point for preclusion by the RLA of ERISA, and that is that the RLA will preclude an ERISA claim only if the ERISA claim for its resolution turns on the construction of the plan terms of the collective bargaining agreement. So the ERISA claim has to, for its resolution, require the construction of the plan. Here that cannot be the case because the central allegation is that the plan itself is illegitimate. If the 1997 plan is illegitimate, let's start a different way. If the 1997 plan is legitimate and therefore the plan's basis for which it denied benefits, if it's legitimate, Mr. Oki agrees that he's not entitled to benefits because it has an express exclusion for furloughed workers. But if it's illegitimate, then the plan must lose, because the only basis that it ever set forth for the denial of benefits, for the termination of benefits, was the 1997 plan. It can't raise new arguments in court. Its administrator never brought this up. Mr. Oki appealed under ERISA to the administrator. Administrator never resolved the appeal, never answered it. 9 years later, we've never received an answer. And so they're not permitted in court to raise these new arguments based on an earlier plan that only come up now on appeal, here even. So if that were the case, once this issue is resolved, the case would be over. Mr. Oki would get his benefits either way. So,
well, wait, I don't understand. If the 97 restatement is invalid, then for him to get benefits, it has to come from some plan, and that's the 75 plan. And the 75 plan says active service.
He was already
receiving. I mean, at least that's at least what U.S. Air is saying.
Well, it's saying that here, now. It's not what the plan administrator or the fiduciary ever said. The plan administrator and fiduciary only relied on the 1997 plan. U.S. Airways can't bring up new arguments for terminating his benefits. He was entitled to benefits. He was getting them. He didn't have to prove an entitlement to benefits. He was already receiving them. The question is whether they can terminate them. And he was, the ERISA law is pretty straightforward that on administrative review, the plan can, if it were...
No, what I'm asking is if it can't be terminated under the 97 restatement because that's invalid, then what is it being paid pursuant to?
The 1975 plan.
Right, the 75 plan.
Yes.
All right. So that is, whether they relied on it or not, that's what's giving him his benefits if the 97 restatement is invalid.
Yes.
All right, and the 75 plan says... active service, which a furloughed pilot is not in active service.
A couple of answers to the question. First of all, to reiterate the point, the plan never made this argument, and it can't now. The cases like Lauder, which we cited in our brief, hold that the plan must abide by the denial that it it stated, which was the 97 plan. So it's come up with these theories now on appeal that the 75 plan has this active service requirement in order to challenge the benefits, but their lawyer's not able to do that. The fiduciary has to do it. Maybe a remand back to the plan administrator to look at that would be appropriate, but this case still wouldn't involve construction of the plan terms because a remand isn't a construction of the plan terms. The ERISA statute is straightforward in giving a right to the party, to Mr. Oki here, and it can only be taken away in the narrow circumstance if the case involves the construction of the plan terms. And under Your Honor's scenario, it would not. It could be remanded, and the plan administrator might have to look at it.
Why isn't that then a construction of the plan's terms? I'm not understanding. The only right you have here is under the plan's terms. And so ERISA takes away, ERISA normally gives you a right, but in this circumstance, when it involves construction of the plan's terms, it goes into a different proceeding, right?
You mean back to the remand?
No, back to the administrative process.
Well, if that were the case and it involves construction there, that's not what the court would be doing. The only question is whether the court, in resolving this case that Mr. Oki brought, would be interpreting the plan terms. And if it sends the case back for a remand, it wouldn't be. It would be saying to the plan administrator, you've now raised a new argument.
Is that the way to think about it? I mean, perhaps it is, but the way I thought about it is he gets relief or doesn't get relief based on what is in the language of the plan. And the RLA says when that's the nature of the dispute, it doesn't belong in federal courts. It belongs before the arbitrator. Now, what's wrong with that scenario?
Well, let's say the plan administrator had said the 1997 plan, let's say they relied on the 1975 plan. They said you're not an active worker.
Right.
That's highly disputed, by the way, that issue. But they say you're not an active worker. Mr. Oki takes the position, yes, I am,
right.
And he goes to court to now challenge the interpretation that the plan
right.
made. That would be the kind of case that I think all these other cases talk about. He's seeking benefits based on a construction of the plan terms
right.
he disagrees with the plan on.
We have no jurisdiction over that, that's right.
If you assume this rule is
right, exactly.
Yes. But that's not what his case is. Instead, they never said that. Instead, they said, here's the 1997 plan. This is why you were denied benefits. It has an exclusion for furloughed workers. We go to court saying, that's wrong. You cannot rely on the 1997 plan. And because it's invalid, that's the end of the case. At that point, it either gets decided that the plan can't raise any new arguments, or it gets remanded back to the plan administrator for the new arguments to be considered by the plan administrator, but in no instance does it involve construction of the plan terms. And that's the key. ERISA gives a cause of action. It can only be taken away in a very narrow circumstance. If for the district judge to resolve the case, he had to look at the plan terms and say there's a dispute about these plan terms. And there wasn't at the start of this case. It was only now that these issues are being raised that there's a dispute. And it's too late under the ERISA law. It's foreclosed from raising the dispute now. But the case, in any event, as Your Honor suggested, could be if it were remanded. Most courts wouldn't remand it, though. It would still not involve the court construing the plan. Perhaps if it were remanded, it could never come back
right.
at that point. It then might have to go to if they fought over this active service requirement, then it would have to go to the arbitration proceeding, assuming that ERISA is precluded by the RLA. But I would like to just, Judge Henderson, talk about this active service requirement. Again, we've been sort of, our side has been baited into talking about the 1975 plan, even though we don't think it's relevant, but by the briefing in the case. But the 1975 plan specifically says that benefits won't start for disability until the waiting period ends, and the waiting period ends when you depart active employment. So this argument that
you say it's not relevant if you win on the invalidity of the 97 restatement.
Yes.
It is. It's the only thing that gives him benefits.
It does, but the court won't have to construe the plan. He was getting benefits. The plan has never, the plan administrator never relied on the plan. But in any event, the 75 plan particularly says that, and this is on at the joint appendix at 589, it has a definition 1.4 benefit waiting period. which is the period ending with the later of the date the pilot becomes disabled or the date the pilot is removed from the active payroll. You don't become eligible for benefits till you become inactive, as it is. A disabled pilot is not an active pilot. And so this whole argument about, well, he was taken out of active service and therefore can't receive disability benefits is a phony in our view, because the disabled pilot isn't in active service to begin with, so the furloughing didn't change that status of activity. There's no way to get around that provision. Instead, it's more of an eligibility issue they're talking about, whether you become covered in the first place. You have to be an active pilot to be covered by the policy in the first place, and he was starting in 1988. So that's our main argument in the case. Just first, I save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. It is reply. Remember that.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Robertson.
May it please the court, Mark Robertson for the U.S. Airways, Inc. Pilot Disability Plan. Appellant has raised a host of issues to an attempt to complicate this matter, but this is a very straightforward case that boils down to a few key facts and is controlled by decisions of this court that are directly on point. As to the facts, there is no dispute here that the disability plan at issue is a collectively bargained plan that is governed by the Railway Labor Act. And second, there is no dispute that appellant's only claim in this litigation is for disability benefits under the plan. As to the key legal issues, there are three. Number one, ERISA itself does not provide for benefits to furloughed pilots. ERISA itself does not provide for benefits at all. And thus, whether or not appellant is entitled to benefits depends on the terms of the plan. Now, in the Northwest case, this court addressed an identical situation and held that an ERISA claim for benefits that requires interpretation of a collectively bargained plan must go to the system board, which has exclusive jurisdiction. Now, the Everett case, which was affirmed by this court, addressed the exact same situation and came to the exact same conclusion.
I think they're concerned as well that the original letter told them to go under ERISA.
Yes, Your Honor. That's come up in a number of cases that are out there where an original letter goes up, because ERISA has statutory requirements that say you have to convey certain things, including that you have a right to state or federal court. And all of those courts have reached the same conclusion, which is that can't generate subject matter jurisdiction. And in fact, Mr. Oki, in his brief below, even cites one of those cases, which is out of the Eighth Circuit, which is Bowe v. Northwest Airlines, 974 F. 2nd 101, and which expressly hold, and Mr. Oki cited for this proposition, you can't create jurisdiction by sending out a letter.
Might help him with the tolling argument on arbitration or something, but not here, right? Estoppel doesn't create jurisdiction.
It doesn't do it here. It can't do it. And in fact, there's actually a case.
What is your position on the tolling in the arbitration?
Whether this is tolled and whether he can pursue arbitration,
mm-hmm.
That's simply a matter for the system board to decide. He needs to bring the claim and make his arguments, and they'll decide it. And
what
in
will,
Northwest,
what will your position be?
The company could oppose it based on it being untimely. They could agree to let him do it. That has to come before the system board, and they'll make their decision. But I would point out, Your Honors, that in the Northwest decision, this court held, and in that argument, Northwest even said in that case, hey, it's been far too long for them to institute a grievance, and if they do, we're going to say it's untimely. And what this court held is said, that is a matter to be determined not in this suit, but in connection with the arbitration process. That's at page, it's the site is 627 F. 2nd at 278 note 12. So, Your Honor, that's a separate question. That's not before this court. The question before this court is whether you have jurisdiction or whether the district court correctly dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction. And now, Mr.
Why is it jurisdictional?
Why is it jurisdictional?
Because Sixth Circuit said it wasn't, right?
Well, the Sixth Circuit did, and the Sixth Circuit got it wrong. And the Sixth Circuit got it wrong for at least five reasons, Your Honor, which I'm happy to go through in some detail.
At least five?
At least five.
Wow. At least five. And it's very important because, to me, Your Honor, from our position, the arguments that, you know, Northwest has been overruled by Buell or the ERISA cases, that's just dead in the water.
But the jurisdictional issue, that's a little closer call, right? I mean, we're getting a lot of direction from up on First Street about jurisdiction. And
yes, Your Honor, you're right. There's a lot of focus on that, and I think that may have led to the Sixth Circuit getting it wrong. And but that is the only argument that really kind of, I think, deserves much attention here, and the only reason is because of the Sixth Circuit case. But let me spend some time walking through why we believe that case is just dead wrong. What the Supreme Court said in Arbol and the subsequent cases is you got to look at the statute, you got to look at the Supreme Court's historical treatment of the statute, and that's how you come to your conclusion. We don't want you to do these drive-by jurisdictional rulings. Then the Sixth Circuit comes out and they do a drive-by ruling. They don't look at the statute at all, they don't analyze it, and they fail to address or even reference the Supreme Court precedent that has directly held system board arbitration is exclusive. And if you'll indulge me, I'll give you just a moment to give you a sense of some of the Supreme Court cases.
Exclusive is different than jurisdictional.
Right.
But if it's exclusively to the court, to the arbitration board, then it is jurisdictional.
And you don't need this, do you? I mean, if it's mandatory requirement, why couldn't we just do it under 12b-6 instead of 12b-1?
You certainly could. At the end of the day...
Then it was forfeited here, I think, is their argument, right?
Their argument, but, Your Honor, on the record here, that argument is dead as well, because even in the Sixth Circuit case, where they did dismiss it under 12b-6 and affirm the lower court's decision. By the way, where they affirm it, they said that the allegations that the plaintiff made in that case of futility, of collusion between the union and the employer were insufficient, and they were still going to dismiss it because there wasn't enough of a facts there. Here there's no facts or no argument whatsoever of collusion, of futility, none of that. It's simply not at play. There's nothing of that sort.
It was still 11 years before you all brought it up, right?
Well, Your Honor, there are some facts there, and, right. and that, including that it was stayed for several years. It was stayed, and this was the
How
first
many
time.
Of the 11 was it stayed?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that, and counsel may know, but it was stayed for several years. And I'd also point out that in the prior iterations of the complaint.
In fact, when was the first time that you all brought up the Railway Labor Act?
We brought it up immediately prior to them filing their second amended complaint, which was the first time in the history of this litigation that there was a sole plaintiff in the case, Mr. Oki. Prior to that, there had been multiple plaintiffs, and that there was a sole claim for benefits. Prior to that, they had brought what we would deem independent statutory disputes, which this court would have jurisdiction over. So it was the first time in the history of this case where the complaint could be moved under subject matter jurisdiction and the entire thing dismissed. And again, I don't think there can be any argument that during the stay, no one was required to raise these issues. Parties engaged in settlement talks. They indicated that they were going to go and move to have the case open, and at that point, the U.S. Airways indicated.
Which is your stronger argument, that there's no jurisdiction or that there's jurisdiction but you didn't forfeit the argument?
Your Honor, I think they're both very strong, and I think the only reason this
equally strong, they're equally strong.
I think the reason that the jurisdictional argument they have some potential legs there is simply because of the Sixth Circuit decision, which
well,
I think
it's not just a Sixth Circuit decision. I mean, our work gets reviewed, right, and gets reviewed by a court that has sent some pretty strong signals that on jurisdiction, right? It's a tough issue.
It's a close call, right?
These are close call issues.
Well, could I spend a few minutes on that then, Your Honor, and tell you?
Your time.
The Sixth Circuit didn't look at the statute itself. And what the statute says, and this is in 45 U.S.C. Section 184, it shall be the duty of every carrier and its employees to establish a board of jurisdiction not exceeding the jurisdiction which may be lawfully exercised under 45 U.S.C. Section 153, which is the section establishing the National Railroad Adjustment Board, which came first in the RLA. And then, in turn, what 45-184 says is that, or what 153 says, is that the NRAB, like the system boards for air carriers, have jurisdiction over disputes between carriers and their employees growing out of the interpretation or application of collective bargaining agreements. And what the Supreme Court has held in a long line of cases from 1950 to the present is that this jurisdiction is exclusive. I can run through the site. Slocum v. Delaware, 339 U.S. 239 at 1950, page 245. We hold that the jurisdiction of the board to adjust grievances and disputes of the type here involved is exclusive, and that involved interpretation of a CBA. 1959, Pennsylvania Railroad v. Day. We have held that the National Railroad Adjustment Board has exclusive primary jurisdiction over disputes between unions and carriers based on the provisions of a collective bargaining agreement. 1963, Supreme Court, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers v. Louisville and Nashville Railroad. The statutory grievance procedure is a mandatory, exclusive, and comprehensive system for resolving grievance disputes. The right of one party to place the disputed issue before the Adjustment Board, with or without the consent of the other, has been firmly established. And this is the other. This is important. And the other party may not defeat this right by resorting to some other forum. 1963. I'll skip to 1972. Andrews v. Louisville and Nashville Railroad. The notion that the grievance and arbitration procedure provided for minor disputes in the Railway Labor Act are optional to be availed of as the employer or the carrier chooses was never good history and is no longer good law. In at least some situations, the Railway Labor Act makes the federal administrative remedy exclusive rather than merely requiring exhaustion of remedies in one forum before resorting to another.
So it's a combination of the precedent saying exclusive and the statutory term in jurisdiction.
That's exactly it, Your Honor. And these cases go on, and they go on all the way until 2009 in Union Pacific Railroad v. Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. This is a case at 558 U.S. 67, 2009. And this is an important case which the Sixth Circuit didn't grapple with or explain at all. And the Sixth Circuit actually held this supports that the arbitration requirement is not jurisdictional. But what this case addresses, Union Pacific, is not the jurisdiction of the courts, but the jurisdiction of the National Railroad Adjustment Board, which is the equivalent of the board here under the law. And what they're addressing is the jurisdiction of that board and whether a pre-conference settlement type conference before parties can go before the board is jurisdictional or not. And what they hold is that pre-settlement conference is not jurisdictional. But in so holding, they address the jurisdiction of the board and say that is it has jurisdiction here. We don't have jurisdiction of this. It should go back to the board. The board shouldn't have kicked it out because the settlement conference didn't happen, which isn't jurisdictional. But the board itself does have jurisdiction. And Your Honor, beyond not addressing the statutory text, beyond not addressing this very long line of Supreme Court authority, you have to look into what the Sixth Circuit did hold, because it got that wrong too. And what it said is they said, the reason we think this is non-jurisdictional is because the Supreme Court in Glover, which is a case involving race discrimination and union employer collusion, they say in Glover, the Supreme Court created an exception. And they did it based on the party's conduct. And under another Supreme Court case, Kontrick, they say that can't be right because you can't create subject matter jurisdiction based on the party's conduct. But the Sixth Circuit misinterpreted both the Glover and the Kontrick case. What Glover held, Glover actually reaffirms the system board's exclusive jurisdiction in disputes between employees and carriers. And let me quote from the Glover case. What it holds is, quote, "It is true that this court has held that the Railroad Adjustment Board," and again, the Railroad Adjustment Board is treated the same as air carrier system boards in all the case law and under statute. "This court has held that the Railroad Adjustment Board has exclusive jurisdiction under Section 3(1) of the Railway Labor Act to interpret the meaning of the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. We have held, however, that Section 3(1), by its own terms, applies only to disputes between an employee or group of employees and a carrier or carriers." The Supreme Court then, in the Glover case, goes on to explain that the dispute in Glover is a dispute between employees and their union and management acting together. And they say, as opposed to a dispute between an employee and a carrier, which is exclusive jurisdiction. And that the Supreme Court then further explains that what it's excusing plaintiffs of in that case is exhaustion of remedies under the CBA, not the mandatory arbitration requirement for disputes between employees and carriers, which it actually reaffirms. And I'd like to make another point there. This is not just me reading Glover and putting out my interpretation of it. This court affirmed the Everett case, which is directly on point. And what Everett said about Glover matches that interpretation exactly. And let me quote, the Supreme Court in Glover, distinguishing analytically between the exhaustion requirement and the mandatory arbitration requirement, noted that futility may be a defense to exhaustion, but not to mandatory arbitration, which is a jurisdictional matter. And so, Your Honor, what I'm putting forth is the Sixth Circuit got its interpretation of Glover wrong. And then it made another leap. It says, under Ryan v. Contrick, they say subject matter jurisdiction can't hinge on the behavior of the parties. And they cite the Contrick case, which actually held that subject matter jurisdiction, it was talking in dicta, but what it says is subject matter jurisdiction cannot be expanded to account for the party's litigation conduct. There's a significant difference between litigation conduct and conduct in general. And if conduct in general can give rise to subject matter jurisdiction depending on the circumstances, and an example of this is the Declaratory Judgment Act. You know, whether there's an actual controversy under the Declaratory Judgment Act is highly dependent on the party's general conduct, maybe not its litigation conduct, but pre-litigation general conduct. And a site for that is Shell Oil Company v. Amoco, 970 F. 2nd, 885-888, which, and I quote, the legal effect of the party's conduct in particular, whether it was sufficient to create an actual controversy, is a question of law which we review de novo. So, Your Honor, in sum, I mean, the five reasons why I think the Sixth Circuit got it wrong is, one, they don't even analyze the statutory text. Number two, they don't address or even reference the long line of Supreme Court cases on point, which Arbaugh and Reed and these other cases hold is what you're supposed to do, look at the historical treatment. Number three, they misinterpret the Supreme Court's decision in Glover. Number four, they misinterpret the Supreme Court's decision in Contrick. And then five, they don't address the Union Pacific case, which just came out in 2009.
You need to wind it up. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just to wind up, they make a lot of arguments about, well, they can't, the litigation counsel can't raise these arguments after the fact. And Your Honor, those cases have no application here. This is not a case where everyone agrees the court has jurisdiction. It's a question of whether the system board has exclusive jurisdiction, and if it does, the system board will decide what arguments it will and won't consider, and the CBA is directly on point and says that the system board can consider whatever evidence it deems admissible. But even assuming for the sake of argument those cases applied here, they're irrelevant because they depend on a complete administrative record. Here there is no administrative records. The system board has never occurred. Number two, they only stand for the proposition that you can't offer a rationale later that you didn't raise earlier. From day one, the plan has said it's been a furlough. Number three, you have to look at the facts. This was an amendment that went into effect in 1997. He's denied these benefits in 2003. He calls up and says, why were they denied? They sent him a page from the 1997 plan that says if you're furloughed, you don't get benefits. There was no allegation whatsoever until this litigation that he claimed the 1997 amendment was invalid. And the last point on that, and I'll sit down, Your Honors, is that what's under the case law, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And the cases, if they do apply, they specifically hold, and I'm quoting Flinders, which Oki cites for the rule that a plan cannot assert new rationales, and I quote, they talk about the converse also applies, and the claimant can't assert new things. And they say this is consistent with the converse rule that a claimant may not urge new grounds outside the administrative record that would support the award of benefits. This was never raised about the 1997 plan being invalid until this litigation. If somehow we were precluded from addressing it, that would be improper under the same cases he cites.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Shelley have? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points about the jurisdictional versus non-jurisdictional question. The Sixth Circuit's case, decision in Emsweiler is not a drive-by ruling. They went through all of the cases starting with Arbaugh and actually expressly mentioned the Union Pacific case. My colleague says they don't, and that comes on page 789 where they discuss the Union Pacific case and say that the Supreme Court has also applied the Arbaugh clear statement test in the context of the RLA. Citing Union Pacific. In Union Pacific, the court decided that noncompliance with the RLA requirement that parties to a minor dispute take part in a pre-arbitration settlement conference prior to bringing their claim to the adjustment board was not jurisdictional. It was the Sixth Circuit wasn't doing a drive-by ruling. In fact, it overruled earlier cases that had said it was a jurisdictional ruling and to come to its own conclusion. Mr. Robertson mentions that the statutory text he cites mentions the word jurisdiction, but it doesn't say the courts don't have jurisdiction. It just talks about the scope of the jurisdiction of the System Adjustment Board. And this
but it does use the word jurisdiction, and there is a lot of precedent that says it's exclusive. And using the term jurisdiction is one of the key things the Supreme Court has said to look for, right?
But the Supreme Court in Reed-Elvezier specifically said, but simply the mention of the word jurisdiction doesn't suddenly turn something into jurisdictional. You have to look at whether it's saying, does the court lack jurisdiction? That's not what is in the statutory text. With respect to how long the defense went without being raised, the case was stayed from about 2000, began in 2003, was stayed from about 2006 to about 2009.
I thought the stay was lifted in May of 11.
I think it was officially lifted in 11, but there were proceedings before then that the parties went through because we had moved to reopen the case. So it probably is fair to say that during that period there were no court proceedings in the case. But this claim has been in the complaint since the very start. It's not fair to say it wasn't in the complaint in 2003. The disability plan was only a named plaintiff for that sole reason, for the disability claim that was claim six. The contour of the claim never changed from 2003 to the later amended complaints. And then one last point I'd like to mention is that the argument now being made that Mr. Oki had the obligation to raise the 1997 plan infirmity during the appellate process, which they never responded to. He did. If you look at his appeal letter in the record, it specifically notes, we don't know where you got this plan. It's undisclosed to us. This doesn't look like the correct plan to us. He specifically said it in his appeal. The plan never responded to that appeal, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway because there's significant case law on the point that all he had to do was appeal. He didn't have to raise specific issues. And I'd point to two cases for that. The Ninth Circuit's Vaught case, V-A-U-G-H-T, at 546 F3rd 620 from 2008. And the Third Circuit's case, Wolf versus National Shopman, 728 F2nd 182 at page 186. That's from the Third Circuit, 1984. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.